From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Saudi-born businessman Adnan Khashoggi is plugged in and well-connected. In the 70s, he brokered billions of dollars in sales of aircraft and arms for the Saudi royal family. In the 80s, he was one of the Iran-Contra middlemen between Oliver North and the mullahs in Iran. Now he's been meeting with Richard Perle, powerful Washington war hawk and chairman of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board. Tonight on Point, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh on ethics and interests on war, Perle, and the Saudi connection. We begin tonight with the latest on the assassination of Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic. He was shot twice in front of his Belgrade offices this morning. He was 50 years old. Djindjic was widely known as a force for democracy in Serbia. Belgrade officials have suggested that his assassination was the work of organized crime powers, angered by his reform efforts. Joining me now is Duško Doder, former Eastern European bureau chief for The Washington Post and author of Milosevic, Portrait of a Tyrant. Duško Doder, you know this part of the world like the back of your hand. What was your first response when you heard the news of the assassination?
Well, to my mind, it had all the earmarks of a political vendetta, you know, the gunman ambushing the prime minister outside the government building, shooting him dead. And it came only 2 weeks ago after Djindjic narrowly escaped death when the car in which he was riding was rammed by a truck. He was going to the airport, and this was the favorite, one of the favorite methods of Milosevic's secret police to remove a political opponents by presenting political assassinations as tragic traffic accidents.
Mm-hmm. He was killed with two shots from a rifle fired by a sniper who fled. The reports are that three people have been arrested. But if this were a political vendetta, what might the shape of that be? Who would want to see him dead?
Well, you know, don't forget, he is the guy who organized the removal of Milosevic, you know, the people's revolution against Milosevic.
Removal from power and
from
to
power.
The international
and then,
court.
And then, more and more significantly, he was the guy who removed him to the court.
Mm-hmm. To The Hague and the International War Crimes
That's
Tribunal.
That's right. And I think that there are plenty of people there who are still in place who wanted to exact revenge. I suspect, however, that there may have been a more immediate reason for this, and that is that it was known that Mr. Djindjic was trying to extradite to The Hague the Bosnian Serb General Ratko Mladic,
mm-hmm.
who is the real criminal in Bosnia. I mean, you know, the political leader Karadzic is sort of a buffoon, but we know for a fact that Mladic was the guy, say, who issued orders and personally supervised the executions at Srebrenica.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, the United States government has been pushing Djindjic to do that, and I think that he was close to doing it.
So Djindjic would have had enemies among supporters of Milosevic. You also refer to sort of gangster elements here, and then to the Ratko Mladic. How do all these intersect? Are they the same? Are the gangsters and the Milosevic crowd the same crew, or are the distinctions here? Is it all one piece?
I think Milosevic's regime was rather unique because it was based on sort of terror that was perpetrated by gangsters who became paramilitary part of his government. And lots of people were, you know, killed. I mean, the defense minister, the interior minister, the deputy interior minister, then Arkan, the notorious warlord, who all served Milosevic, were killed under similar circumstances, either in a hotel or in a restaurant and so forth, because all these people had, you know, had intimate knowledge of what Milosevic was up to. The problem here is that Mladic is being protected not only by the extreme nationalists in Serbia, but also by the military, because he was a Yugoslav military officer, and Milosevic paid his salary all the way.
So describe for us what Gingrich's position was as he strolled down the steps there this morning. Had he been hung out to dry, left high and dry by the United States and other Western European capitals? Was he being asked to do the impossible? Was he being given the support required to survive in that difficult environment?
Well, I don't think he had been given much support. I mean, you know, then here I talk about economic support because we gave him political support, but, you know, in a country that's been devastated by sanctions, by incompetent governments, tyrants, and so forth, and finally by the bombing, see, you know, he had very little to work with. But, you know, to his credit, this is a man who was a modern guy. I met him first when I was a Washington Post correspondent in Belgrade in 1970s, and he was a student, and there was a student. They tried to organize independent student unions in 1974 or something, and then he was arrested, and he couldn't continue his education, so he went to Germany and he got a PhD in philosophy in Germany. So he's very well educated, absolutely fluent in German. And a modern man, a pragmatist, but, you know, in the Balkans, they, you know, sometimes people are suspicious of very well-educated people.
So did powers there feel that he had been imposed on Balkan politics by the West?
Not really, no. I think that, you know, there's a distinction here. He organized a party, he fought and so forth. He was not popular, but he was a guy who was willing to make tough decisions. And, you know, extraditing Milosevic was one such tough decision, and imposing economic reforms and an economic discipline on the population that's in fairly dire straits is also not popular.
The Serbian government is a fairly gangly coalition. It depends on Mr. Milosevic's old party for a majority in parliament. Today, it immediately declared a state of emergency. Duško Dodor, where do you see Serbia going in the aftermath of this assassination? What's the direction?
Down, down, down. I think that, you know, it's a country that is you know, it's disintegrated. Yugoslavia no longer exists. The Federation of Serbia and Montenegro does not have a president. It's a kind of a nebulous thing that is not going to last. I can't see a great future for the country. And I thought that Gingrich, for all his shortcomings, was one bright spot there because he really was a modern man and he tried to do what was required.
Duško Dodor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Duško Dodor is a former East European bureau chief for the Washington Post and author of Milosevic, Portrait of a Tyrant. Late this afternoon, the Serbian government said a Belgrade-based criminal group was behind today's assassination of the prime minister. A high-ranking police official is among the suspects. For over 30 years, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Seymour Hersh has been throwing a blazing spotlight on Shadow America. The man who wrote the first account of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam has now trained his sights on Washington and the unseen webs behind the war on terror and war on Iraq. Richard Perle is one of the biggest Bush hawks driving the Washington war push. He's chairman of the Defense Department's influential, confidential Defense Policy Board. He is also, Seymour Hersh reports this week, the managing partner of a venture capital firm investing in post-9/11 security opportunities, who is walking a very narrow ethical line between national policy and private interest, between Saudi money, a former Iran-Contra middleman, and war on Iraq. Seymour Hersh takes us to a quiet lunch in Marseille just weeks ago between Pearl and the money men to startling conversations and memos where influence, ethics, and motivations make unnerving bedfellows. Is this just power having its way? Is this a subtext to war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His latest article, Lunch with the Chairman, appears in this week's New Yorker magazine. Good evening and welcome, Seymour Hersh.
Hello.
Hello, and thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Seymour Hersh, you describe Richard Perle, who is, as we know, a very powerful mind and intellect and power broker in the Bush administration, as crisscrossing between the public and private sectors in a way not uncommon to public men, but nevertheless at a very interesting moment in time. You say he's credited with being the intellectual force behind war. At the same time, he set up a company that may gain from war. Would you be good enough to outline the scheme that you describe in your quite arresting article of relationships and ethical lines, if not crossed, then rubbed right up against?
You know, there's nothing illegal in what he did. He's not a full-time member of the government. He's chairman of an advisory board. There are certain rules and codes of conduct he has to follow. Essentially, he has to avoid any appearance of a conflict as much as a conflict. One of his obligations is to not in any way be seen to using his very special privilege as chairman of this committee, which gets top secret briefings, et cetera, and also, of course, his own role as a major, as you describe, sort of an intellectual force on the war against Iraq.
And we've got all that. That there is nothing illegal here, but we're not listening tonight as lawyers. We're listening as citizens of a country that may soon be at war, and simply wanting to understand, reality as it plays out these days and maybe many days. You describe a kind of nexus created between Richard Perle and a rather flamboyant figure, Adnan Khashoggi. Could you introduce Adnan Khashoggi to us?
That's the key. Adnan Khashoggi sort of burst into fame or infamous during the 1980s Iran-Contra scandals. These are the scandals in the Reagan administration when it was discovered that Ronald Reagan, despite all his public protestations to the contrary, was in fact secretly exchanging arms to the Iranians for the release of hostages. Mm-hmm. And the middleman in that deal was Adnan Khashoggi, who had become pretty much known in the business world in the late 1960s and early 1970s as a broker for the Saudi government. He was a Saudi businessman who, when the Saudis began to make enormous amounts of money and nationalize their oil companies and decided to get into the arms business and the weapons business, he was the major purchaser for them.
So Adnan Khashoggi made a name for himself and a lot of money in that brokerage business.
Fortune magazine figured out that he'd made as much as $600 million in commissions that we might call payoffs in America on various deals. He was a jet setter, the whole story, private planes, 8 homes, always on the telephone, flamboyant with women. Really, a great character, almost a caricature of a character.
And you describe meeting him in the Riviera, but before we get that, let's introduce the other side of Richard Perle that we might not know as well as his role as chairman of the Defense Policy Board. He's also a managing partner in a venture capital company called Trireme Partners. Could you, registered in November 2001, interesting date, what is the genesis and purpose or focus of Trireme Partners?
We don't know much about it. What I know mainly about it registered in Delaware because you don't have to list all the offices in Delaware. It's mm-hmm. one of the states a lot of corporations work in because of secrecy laws in the state. It was registered a few months after 9/11, obviously, in November. Mm-hmm. And its purpose was essentially homeland security, the idea of raising a lot of money to finance and set up companies that would get contracts to build, among the things that specifically I know about, machines, HEPA vacuum machines that could keep homes safe in case of a chemical or biological breakout. The idea being there's a potential, billion-dollar market, among Americans and around the world.
So some room here for security entrepreneurs, an investment, and perhaps big money to be made.
Totally. And there's a lot of companies doing it. I mean, that's the way it is.
And Trireme, as in the technological breakthrough that made the ancient Greeks so powerful on a small sea. They were working on a much bigger stage here tonight. Seymour Hersh, stand by. We're just setting the table here. We want to come back and go through in detail because it's fascinating detail that you've laid out. This week in The New Yorker, we're talking tonight with investigative reporter Seymour Hersh about ethics, hidden interests, and the subtext, maybe, of war with Iraq. His latest report in The New Yorker examines Saudi money, private interests, and Pentagon Defense Policy Board Chairman Richard Perle. Are we getting the whole story on Washington interests and war with Iraq? Does it surprise you to hear the allegation that a prominent Bush war hawk has related private interests on the side? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with investigative reporter Seymour Hersh about ethics, hidden interests, and the subtext, maybe, of war with Iraq. His latest report in the New Yorker magazine examines Saudi money, private interests, and Pentagon Defense Policy Board Chairman Richard Pearl. Does it surprise you to hear the allegation that a prominent Bush war hawk has related private interests on the side? If it's not illegal, is it right? Might it be wrong? Can we live with even the appearance of policymakers profiting from war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Seymour Hersh, you've set the table for us here. We've got Adnan Khashoggi, flamboyant, big money, wheeler dealer internationally with Saudi-born, deep ties in the Middle East. On the other side, Richard Pearl, chairman of the Defense Policy Board, which has been very influential in helping set Bush administration defense policy and in the push to war with Iraq, and also a managing partner with Trireme Partners, which you say has been outraising money and big money, including with a letter that specifically mentioned the firm's government connections very prominently, saying three of Trireme Management Group's members currently advise the U.S. Secretary of Defense.
That's right, and in the letter that was sent to Mr. Khashoggi that he kindly let me have access to, it also says the letter talks about raising $45 million to start, and they're looking for more money. Now, the important thing about Khashoggi is that, of course, he's a Saudi, and the other thing one should know about Richard Pearl is he's, among other things, a very pro-Israel and has been all of his life, and has been very anti-Saudi. He's been especially critical of the Saudis since 9/11, accusing them publicly, repeatedly, of funding terrorism. And the Saudis do have a reputation for essentially buying off people that give them trouble. And he's been giving the Saudis nothing but trouble. He's been very hostile to the Crown Prince Abdullah, who's been eager to get talks going between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And that's all been something Pearl has been very sort of openly critical about. The one thing I have to say about Richard Pearl is you do know where he stands on most things. He's
yes.
very public.
He's been on this show and very upfront, though I should say for the record, he specifically declined to join this program with you tonight, Cy Hersh.
Well, he's been doing that quite a bit, and I'm sure we'll get to that in a minute, mm-hmm. His reaction to the story. But the point is, so for Richard Pearl to be involved in a meeting with Khashoggi, who's a Saudi, and Khashoggi tried to induce other wealthy Saudis to the meeting, one reason for going to Saudi Arabia, above the fact there's so much money there, is that the Saudis are in the middle of a huge homeland security program. They've already spent $1 billion sort of monitoring their borders. They have a long border with Yemen and borders mm-hmm. with Iraq and borders with Jordan, and they're very worried about people coming across those borders and getting their oil. And they're going to be spending billions of dollars in the next few years improving their security. So they're a natural place to go to. But the problem is that for Pearl to approach the Saudis has, I actually quote the ambassador to Washington from Saudi Arabia, the Prince Bandar,
yes.
who's been here for 20 years, whose father is Sultan, the defense minister, mm-hmm. A high-ranking member of the royal family. He says that Pearl, essentially, it's the word he used is blackmail. Others have used the word like shakedown. Going to the Saudis suggests that if we give Pearl the investment that he wants, $100 million.
For his private venture capital firm.
That it's not his. I mean,
well, he's a managing partner. He's certainly
he's one of five or six key partners.
Who would profit from any profits from this firm?
Absolutely. If whether this is Pearl's understanding, it certainly was the understanding of the Saudis involved mm-hmm. that perhaps Pearl, if he got this money, would moderate his public criticism of the Saudis. That's one reason one gets money from the Saudis. They tend to give people money to go away.
So that looks like one kind of quid pro quo. There are others, and we'll get to them, but I want to be sure that it's crystal clear to our listeners exactly what transpired here, Cy Hersh, that there was a meeting not long ago, a lunch in Marseille, where Richard Pearl sat down with
Mr. Khashoggi, the great broker of all time, mm-hmm. and a very wealthy Saudi businessman that had been brought to the table by Khashoggi, a man named Harp Zuhar, an industrialist who wanted to invest money, who was willing to invest money in Trireme. Mm-hmm. There had been an earlier meeting with Khashoggi and Zuhar and some other officials of Trireme, not Pearl.
Gerald Hillman, another an investor and associate in New York.
And someone who, without any real credentials, was put on the Defense Policy Board by Pearl, which is sort of very interesting.
Where he also sits, we should note, with another member of an advisory board to this venture capital group, Trireme, that being Henry Kissinger.
Right, who's also on the Defense Policy Board. The board, actually, it's a very conservative board, but it's got a number of former CIA directors and secretaries of state and secretaries of defense. And then there's Jerry Hillman, who's Pearl's business partner, who's also on the board.
And maybe we should take just a little time out here to describe what the Defense Policy Board is. Where did it come from, and what's its sway today, Cy Hirsch?
Well, it was set up in the 80s, and the idea being a very rational idea, which is that there are a lot of people that, former generals and admirals who went in the private industry, who have a lot to contribute, but they don't want to work for the government. They can't afford to. They're in high-powered positions, or they're retired. It gives the American government a chance to get a lot of expertise on policy issues and some acquisition issues, some weapons issues, et cetera. They get the advantage with the, and the people can continue in private life. And most of the people on the board find it a fascinating business. I talked to four members of the board, one of whom I quote very vigorously upset about the Pearl's involvement. And
so it seems to me this is at the edge or off the ethical charts.
Yes. That's what he said.
I would think it would stink to high heaven. But the quote is, but these board members get access to classified information, to senior policy makers in the administration, in the defense establishment.
Absolutely, sometimes higher than top secret. They have total access. Everything inside the board is confidential or higher. It's a private group. They're all cleared by, you know, they get through FBI clearances for handling classified material. It's a sensitive group. Under Pearl, the Defense Policy Board has become enormously influential because he's so influential. In other words, he's the man who's been, literally, we said it, you can't repeat it enough. If there's any one single guru in public life today that's put us in the position of thinking that the way to solve the problems of 9/11 is to go after Iraq, whether you like it or don't like the policy, it's his policy.
Well, and more than that, this is a policy of regime change in Iraq, or a goal that far predates 9/11.
Well, absolutely. Pearl was among a group of people. Some of his close friends include Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of State, Douglas Feith, the Undersecretary of Defense, the number three man.
In the Pentagon.
Wolfowitz is number two in the Pentagon, and of course he's close to Rumsfeld. His push is primarily on that side in the Pentagon.
Now, as chairman of the Defense Policy Board, he's different than the other members. He's a special government employee, therefore subject, you write, to the Federal Code of Conduct.
Which is simply that it's a very common sense code. You can't use your position, even as an advisor, for financial gain. And more than that, you can't shape your policies for financial gain or the policies of the government. And you also have to avoid, and this is critical, the appearance of a conflict, because that's, of course, that's an essential part of conducting your business. You can't get involved in areas. And obviously, Trireme would be, I think it'd be reasonable to assume, is close to one anyway, where there's a sense of conflict. You know, here he is advocating a war with a company that's involved in Homeland Security. In any case, there were meetings set up to which Pearl was not invited in Paris by members of Trireme. Khashoggi shows up with Zuhar. Khashoggi's the broker.
The Saudi money man.
Yes, and Zuhar's the money. And Zuhar wants to talk about ending the war and peace. And they then arrange a second meeting, a lunch in Marseille with Pearl.
In the south of France, where Mr. Pearl has a vacation home.
He has a house, I think, in Provence, and Khashoggi has a home in Cannes. They're both about an hour away from Marseille. They had the lunch.
What was the date of the lunch, Cy Hirsch?
I think the January 3rd is the best date.
So we're talking just a couple of months ago.
Right after New Year's.
Yes.
Right. And at that point, simply put, Pearl makes the point, and I quote him as saying that it wasn't about business. And of course, the answer is, no business was discussed. They simply talked policy. But of course, I quote Khashoggi and even Zuhar as saying, obviously, Pearl is there to close the deal. He's there to show the power of Trireme. They can bring Pearl to a potential investor to talk about foreign policy. Talk about ending a war in a way that is something short of an all-out war by America. That there was no way Pearl or Zuhair or Khashoggi seriously understood that was the part, what was going on. What was going on was business, and that's what I quote people as saying.
When you begin to talk with Richard Pearl and with his associate at Trireme, Gerald Hillman, what was their response? Were they forthcoming about these meetings? Were they glad to talk about it? You know, was it all fresh air and light, or something else?
Well, you know the answer to that question, Counselor. And the answer to that question is, in all years of dealing with Richard Pearl, I've always had respect for him because he's straightforward. In this case,
yes.
He asked me very quickly whether I knew about the lunch. I'd been told about the lunch, but I did not know with whom he had the lunch. I knew about the company, but I did not know with whom he had the lunch. That's important. And I asked Richard. Richard said that lunch, he did have a lunch, but it was only about foreign policy and ending the war with some interested Saudis. And I said, Richard, it's real easy. Tell me who you had lunch with. I'll call him. And if that's correct, I have no story.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he asked me if I knew with whom he had lunch. And at that time, I did not. And he said he would call him and get back to me, and he did not do that. And therefore, within a few days, I knew there was something about it. When I kept on working, eventually what happened, I'll simply tell you what happened. Eventually, mm-hmm. I found my way to the Saudi ambassador who gave me the name.
Prince Bandar.
Bandar of mm-hmm. Zuhar, and I got a hold of Zuhar somewhere. Saudis, you know, it's Rome one day, Paris the next, homes all over. I found Zuhar, and he told me about Khashoggi, and once I hear the name Khashoggi, I know why Richard Pearl can't tell me. For anybody with a memory, Khashoggi, the Iran-Contra fixer, the guy, this, if you remember the Iran-Contra case,
sure.
It got blown up when Oliver North mm-hmm. tried to not only use the sell arms to the Iranians for releasing hostages, he was also trying to get money for the Contras in violation of all common sense.
And Khashoggi was the middleman between North and the mullahs in Iran.
Exactly. For money. I mean, he was making mm-hmm. money. And mm-hmm. it basically makes it more interesting. It later turned out, subsequent investigations turned out, that Khashoggi's money that he lost a great deal of money dealing with the Reagan administration because they, if you remember, everything became public and it was a mess. Mm-hmm. They got exposed. The National Security Advisor, Mr. McFarlane, went to Iran secretly with a cake. It was all crazy. Mm-hmm. And sort of catching, like a kid's play. In any case, Khashoggi had borrowed money from the failed bank of the bank of
BCCI. So it got very. So here's a guy with all kinds of speckles up and down his back, and yet we hear him talking to you, Cy Hirsch, and kind of wagging his finger at the ethics of these very high powered Americans. He says, "You Americans blind yourself with your high integrity and your democratic morality against peddling influence, but they were peddling influence." I guess he means at that lunch at Marseille.
Exactly. His point was, we make such a big. His point was, the whole reason for the lunch in Marseille, the cover story was that Pearl was there to talk about foreign policy. Zuhar wanted to plead with America not to overthrow Saddam and violently. And maybe get him to exile, et cetera. It was very childish in a way. And, of course, that wasn't going to happen. And Pearl and Khashoggi certainly knew that. Zuhar is willing to, you know, to raise an awful lot of money, $100 million,
mm-hmm.
with friends and his own money, if he could get some sort of a commitment or whatever. And in any case, Khashoggi just thought it was almost funny that here's this man, Pearl, who's been so critical. I don't think he minded talking to me. He didn't initiate this, mm-hmm. obviously. I flew to France within hours of his agreeing to see me mm-hmm. because it's such
hey,
a
hey, grab
story.
It while it's hot, yeah.
The point being, so here's Pearl, you've got it. Here's Pearl
mm-hmm.
in a private lunch in a restaurant with somebody he doesn't want to tell me about because it's per se a problem. Pearl's a managing director of a company that's doing a huge amount of business. And among, you know, and so there you are. I mean, all one has to do is what I did, which is, quote, Khashoggi at length, quote Mr. Zuhar at length.
Mm-hmm. And the story tells itself.
Yes, and put him on the record, and away I go. It's an obvious story.
But it's quite a story. I mean, to have the curtains pulled back like this, I have to say I found it really eye-popping. Maybe it's not illegal, but holy smokes, this is the guy who's driving policy, and the other foot is on a different kind of pedal. Cy Hirsch, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us, want to try and get some in here. Peter's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Peter. You're on the air. Hello, Peter. Are you there? No, I think we lost Peter. Let's turn to Josh. Welcome, Josh. You're on the air. Hello, Josh. Have we got you there? Oh, geez. I'm afraid they've dropped off. Cy Hirsch, you go on to quote Prince Bandar, who, of course, has been Saudi ambassador to the United States for a long time, saying, There's a split personality to Pearl. Here he is, on the one hand, trying to make a $100 million deal, and on the other hand, there were elements of the appearance of blackmail. If we get in business, he'll back off of Saudi Arabia. Is that fair coming from Prince Bandar? He's taken a lot of heat from Richard Pearl, as you say. Is this just him getting some of his own back here when he finds Richard Pearl in an exposed situation?
Well, I do say in the article that Pearl's going to the Saudis and having those meetings exposed them to a pretty violent counterattack by the Saudis. So it's clear that there was certainly a great deal of, you could almost say, pleasure or amusement in Bandar. And I think one of the reasons he was willing to go on the record is there's no love lost for Richard Pearl. But I will also tell you that that concept, the notion that Pearl, because of his criticism of Saudi Arabia going to the Saudis for money, struck a lot of people with the same sort of notion. The word I heard often was shakedown, not blackmail. Mm-hmm. Sort of like, and again, there's no reason, I have no basis for knowing what was in Pearl's mind. It could have been he's simply looking for a deal.
And he says, we should note that at this lunch, there was no specific conversation about money. And are you conceding maybe that's true? That it was just in the air.
I think Pearl's idea was to have absolutely no conversation about money. As Zuharb told me, he at one point brought up the $100 million. He mentioned the $100 million, but he brought it up without any prodding, my guess is. Mm-hmm. The point is, of course, is that the whole issue of what you're talking about, it's the appearance of a conflict, is there whether you talk about money or not. The purpose of that meeting was not seriously about a foreign policy discussion. It was to keep Zuhar online for his $100 million. And also it was about money. There was more than just that. If the Saudi government did go ahead and the next round of its homeland defenses and authorize it, as it's in the process of doing, a few billion dollars more in spending, Trireme was going to set up a number of companies that would do business in Saudi Arabia. And the idea was, and this was made explicit to me by Zuhar and also by Khashoggi, that members of Trireme could, once these companies were set up, could choose on their own to invest individually in the companies. And then those companies, lo and behold, might get very large contracts from the Saudi government.
So it's this wonderful circle of hands washing one another. And in the background to all this, and we'll come back and talk about it in a moment, but in the background, Sahersh, is war. And you describe any number of the players here having a view on how these conversations might impact or be impacted by war with Iraq.
Absolutely. Khashoggi, is one of the great lines he said to me was, this is Homeland Security is a business that gets better with war. War is good for it. And here he is pushing war. Pearl's answer to that is he believes that a war in Iraq would make the world safer and reduce the chances of terrorism, reduce the chances of a continued war. And therefore, the notion that Khashoggi had, that I quote Khashoggi as saying that the war is good for business, is wrong.
Backwards by Pearl's lights. Sahersh, stand by. We're talking with investigative reporter Seymour Hersh about ethics, hidden interests, and the subtext of war with Iraq. Who's minding the store here? Are ethics sliding in Washington, or is this par for the course? And can Richard Pearl be an honest policymaker and honest businessman when interests overlap this way? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with investigative reporter Seymour Hersh about ethics, hidden interests, and the subtext of war with Iraq. His latest report in The New Yorker magazine examines Saudi money, private interest, and Pentagon Defense Policy Board Chairman Richard Pearl. Seymour Hersh calls him the intellectual force behind war with Iraq, but that's not all. There are business interests at work here, as you've heard. Are we getting the whole story on Washington interests and war with Iraq? Can we live with even the appearance of policymakers profiting from war? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Peter's calling from Milwaukee. Peter, I'm glad we got you back.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Loud and clear.
Wonderful. I just want to thank you all very much for this conversation, and I'm so grateful for this work that the man has done about Milai before. I wanted to ask a question very much about this issue of the subtext of the war and what really is going on. I've been trying to get more information and more understanding of people like Richard Pearl and Douglas Weiss and Paul Wolfowitz, all of which our guest has mentioned. in connection with this idea of the unipolarist agenda, namely that the war with Iraq is really just a first step of a big plan that's already been made to go for one country after another, in which Saudi Arabia is included by some of the unipolarists, I believe.
So you'd like Cy Hirsch's take on that, and I guess we'd like to have that too. Peter, thanks for your call. Cy Hirsch, you've been spending a lot of time on many facets of the war on terror, the potential war in Iraq, all of this. What is your take on if you had to explicate the subtext here, or at least the thinking as you've come to understand it, of this knot of individuals, intellectual colleagues in the defense establishment, how would you describe it?
Well, they have talked very openly to me. The men you mentioned, Richard Perle in particular, about after Iraq, then you do Iran. The idea being that we clean up the terror organizations, and they describe that as would releasing a group in terms of Israel, which is one of the subtexts here also is support for Israel. In terms of Israel, this would get rid of two of their major enemies in the region, Iraq and Iran. There'd be more stable governments, democratic governments, what you will.
And Iran, of course, a longtime sponsor of Hezbollah, which is giving Israel a lot of trouble.
And once that would happen, their argument is that this would then make Israel relax a little bit and also show the Palestine Liberation Organization that they had better shape up because their aid, their supporters in Iraq and Iran were gone, those people that share their values about stopping Israel, and more moderate leadership would emerge from the Palestinians, and some deal could be made. And that's their story. That's
so that this is kind of the long and winding road to a two-state solution with Israel and the Palestinians would wend its way through Iraq, Iran, perhaps elsewhere, and end up with a more relaxed Israel, a more moderate Palestinian side, and peace.
And also, of course, we would then have the advantage of having access to the enormous amounts of oil in Iraq, which are actually some people think are the reserves, are always publicly listed at about a little less than about 40% of those known to be in Saudi Arabia. But many oil people think we really don't know. Iraq could have two or three times as much oil, perhaps mm-hmm. even more oil than Saudi Arabia. And it's the kind of oil that we value. We buy a lot of oil right now in the United States indirectly from third parties from Iraq because it's sweet oil. It's oil that can go right into our refineries.
Right.
And so... And in that same picture, of course, is Saudi Arabia, if there's trouble there, the idea is you remake the world. This is the violin music in the background of the thinking that goes on. And even down the line, one of the enemies of this particular group of people, these neoconservatives, mm-hmm. China in the long run is seen as a potential threat too.
So it's all about America wielding a really big stick, but in American interests and in the interest, as they would describe it, of peace, of a more democratic world.
Hegemony.
That's a word that comes to mind, too.
And also preemptive. These are all mm-hmm. words that began to be used after the Gulf War by the think teams and think tanks during the Clinton years, of which Perle and Feith and Wolfowitz were contributors to, a number of other people in the administration, which you've had really in America. Is almost a radical takeover of the government. This is not Republican. This is pretty a radical group, and it's been a pretty extreme takeover, and with enormous success, I would say at this point. I mean, we're sort of at it. We're at loggerheads over Iraq, but the President of the United States is the President of the United States. He can order the troops, and they will go.
And these men have his ear. I mean, it's one thing to have you lay out this vision, and we've heard it before, and it's very grand, and it scares the pants off a lot of people. Others are inspired by it. But when we see Richard Perle then, breaking bread in this way, he says there's no business here, but the other parties there say, oh, there sure was. You write, Cy Hirsch, that powerful people often have these kind of split interests. But does this press the bounds? Is Richard Perle or anybody capable of breaking bread at that table in Marseille and also being an upright, unbiased, generator of American foreign policy?
Well, he would say, of course he can. He does say, of course he can. I say that I'm not a cop. I'm not a policeman. I'm not an ethical policeman. I say that the fact that Richard Perle had lunch with Adnan Khashoggi in Paris and is involved heavily in a business that depends on war, in my belief, to be successful, raises questions. and I think they're questions that need to be answered. I don't see any sign. I know I ran into somebody on, you know, as they say in Washington, on the Hill, I ran into an aide to a senator mm-hmm. who said they've been bombarded, not bombarded, he's gotten, you know, more than two or three or four calls to begin an investigation or at least an inquiry into what happened into this story. And as you know, Pearl's response to my story was quite horrific.
Tell us. I guess I don't know entirely.
On CNN on Sunday, he was asked on the Wolf Blitzer show, mm-hmm. and he called me a terrorist.
A terrorist.
He described me as a terrorist. There's been a lot of back and forth on the Internet and elsewhere and mm-hmm. in the media. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he accused me of, he said, I am a terrorist of American journalism, which is a very ungainly word and indicated a, to me it indicated a state of mind that really exists. That it, you know, the people running our government, that's a small cocoon. For a small group of people around the president, Mr. Cheney, Mr. Rumsfeld, some of the advisors. And in that group, if you're with them, you're a hero. And if you're against them, you're not against them. You're a traitor.
There's an ist I would apply to you, but it's journalist, Seymour Hersh.
Well,
Josh is calling. Welcome, Josh. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I have a comment to make. It's a fairly simple point, and I think anyone listening to this whole conversation would easily share the same point of view. And if I'd love to hear the other side if it exists, but basically, I think anyone who's making policy in Washington shouldn't stand to gain anything from it. And no matter how high you are, you're human. Your point of view can be swayed if you stand to make a profit from it. And I think that not only should America be judging people from that point of view, but now more than ever, the whole world is judging us from that point of view. And if people are doing that, I don't think we should give anybody any excuse to question the motivation that we go to war if we go.
Well, what do you do about it, Josh? Here it is. It's in black and white. Everybody's reading it. Richard Pearl's mad as heck about it. But if you're a citizen and you're not happy about it, what would you like to see done?
I think he should answer for it. I think he should be grilled, just like Clinton was grilled for Whitewater, just like Bush is being given a very hard time over drilling in the Arctic because he's an oil man and he stands to benefit possibly from that. I think this guy should be treated no differently.
Josh, we've got it. Cy Hersh, is that likely to happen? Are there Democrats in Washington who are prepared to, you know, call a hearing, or Republicans for that matter?
Nobody has said a word. We've got a supine Congress. And, you know, what Josh is talking about is not only the conflict, but, of course, the other side of it, the appearance of conflict, that if it looks like there's some sort of economic determination driving our policy, it undercuts our policy, undercuts the integrity of our leadership or of our national effort. And so that's one issue. But one of the other issues, of course, is we've had, you know, probably the most serious collapse in the last 30 years that gets remarked on so little has been the collapse of Congress, not just the Democratic Party, which we know is in shambles, but the party, Congress itself, is a functioning institution that takes a stand and that has hearings and that gets involved in public policy.
I'm not sure Americans fully appreciate that. Why do you think that is so? Why has it happened, Cy Hersh?
I actually, my own personal guess is I think Congress has gotten about, you know, dumber. I think the people in Congress are less smart, and the good ones keep their head down. Chris Dodd is a very bright guy. There's certainly very many bright people in Congress, but there's so many that just don't raise their head and stay low profile. And, you know, in the days when I was a kid in Washington, in the early days of the Vietnam War, we had Wayne Morris and Gruning, and we had these amazing senators that made these impassioned speech. Senator Byrd of West Virginia has been making marvelous speeches about the war and Congress and the Senate's failure to debate the war, but nobody reports them.
Cy Hersh, 20 seconds. Is there more grist here for the investigative journalist? Are you still in the vein of war on Iraq, war on terror?
Oh, yeah. I've been doing this since 9/11. And I'm saying, you know, obviously it's the story of this era anyway, and it's probably going to get worse.
It sure is the story. Seymour Hersh, we're very grateful to you for coming on this evening and talking with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good night.
Seymour Hersh is author of his latest article, Lunch with the Chairman. It appears in this week's New Yorker. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, raising the morale of troops in Kuwait. This is On Point. When Pamela Bates' husband shipped out to Kuwait in early January to prepare for possible war with Iraq, she worried about getting lonely and depressed, so she decided to start a little project to keep herself busy. Bates launched a small website to match soldiers in her husband's unit with ordinary Americans who would want to adopt them. The adopters are given a soldier's mailing address and are encouraged to regularly correspond with letters and care packages. Little did Pamela Bates realize how busy she would become. Over the past 3 months, Bates has received emails from 35,000 volunteers. She's arranged for the adoption of 12,000 troops, and not just in her husband's unit. She currently faces a backlog of 14,000 servicemen and women waiting to be adopted. In this radio diary, Pamela Bates says her Hugs to Kuwait project has not only helped the morale of thousands of soldiers, it has helped her morale as well.
The program for me has meant staying busy and not allowing myself to sit around and mope around and think about the fact that my husband is over 7,000 miles away from me at the moment. He had just returned from Korea when he got redeployed to Kuwait, so we had already been apart a year. And that causes some sadness. And, of course, with as busy as I am right now, I don't have time to feel sorry for myself anymore. It's all busy and trying to help other people. And I think that through doing that, you know, I'm helping myself. I don't think so much about my loneliness when I'm trying to address someone else's loneliness. I get letters all the time from the soldiers saying thank you. One of the male personnel that's from Doha over there says that he's the most popular guy in the camp now because everybody waits for him to come along because they know he's going to have mail for them. And, you know, we've had feedback like some soldiers that had, you know, were not on the list because they do have to volunteer their own names or their family has to give me their names. This is a volunteer on both ends program. And I've gotten letters from guys saying, you know, I'm not getting any mail. Could you please add my name? So it's been good feedback, and I believe that it's helping a lot of people, not just the military, but it helps those that are adopting to show their appreciation a little bit. I think it started something that needs to be done. I filter through a lot of them because I always want to glance at them to see, you know, what they are, you know, what if they have a story behind them, because a lot of times the people that are writing in that are wanting to adopt a soldier, they were Vietnam veterans, or they were in Desert Storm, or they lost a father in a conflict. And you like to read those stories. You like to hear why, you know, what the purpose of their becoming involved in the program is. And that's one of the things that really helps with the program. That's one of the things that helps me, because I see that we're all connected somehow with the military. We may not think we are, but if we sit down and think about it for a few minutes, we'll realize that somewhere, some point in time, the military has touched us directly, notwithstanding what they do every day, you know, for our country. I had never in my wildest imagination thought that it would do what it's doing now. I'm absolutely thrilled that it is, but in my wildest imagination, I would have never dreamed that it would take off like this. You know, it really warms my heart to know that there are so many people out there that care so much, because every day when I wake up without my husband here, I know that he's protecting a country that really appreciates him. You know, sometimes it may not seem so, but I know from the response that I've gotten just to this website, and there are others, you know, similar to me, that there are a lot of people that care a whole lot about what these guys and girls are sacrificing.
Pamela Bates lives in Fort Benning, Georgia. Her husband is currently stationed in Kuwait with 1st Battalion of the 10th Artillery Regiment. To learn more about her project and adopting U.S. troops, go to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.